argument against the Christian worldview perspective of nature. And your discussion after class indicated to me that it is something that's hitting a number of you. So we'll continue that discussion today based on the first several verses of Job 40, which I'll read to you in a minute. But you know, it's been a long time since I've come to you with some new scientific discoveries that give us more evidence for the Christian faith. I got a couple that are related. Normally I only give you one, but I'm going to give you two because the two are related to one another. And these both concern, they're both, by the way, were published in the last two issues of Science magazine. Science is a magazine put up by the American Association for Advancement of the Sciences. They call it a magazine, but it's really a journal. It's on the par with, say, the British journal Nature. But unlike Nature, they tend to publish a lot more space science and NASA-related articles. And they're the primary journal that's putting out the cutting-edge stuff on what NASA's discovering in the different planets. And these two papers are going to talk about are both having to do with Mars. And you know, there's orbiters going around Mars, and there's rovers on the surface of Mars. But a couple of scientists from Caltech and MIT said, you know, there's all this attention on the rovers and the orbiters. Let's just look at the meteorites that we've gotten from Mars. And scientists have a little more than 20 meteorites that they've recovered that they know came from Mars. And you say, how do we know they came from Mars? Because you kind of break them open and you look at the little gas pockets inside the meteorite. You know, those gas pockets have the same atmospheric abundances as you have in the atmosphere of Mars. That tells you it's a Martian meteorite. And, you know, scientists can do that with very high confidence. So when they find these meteorites, and by the way, one of the easiest places to look for meteorites is the Arctic and the Antarctic. Because as you walk around those big ice fields that have been stable ice for millions of years, you can basically count on the fact that any rock you see there is a meteorite. So you pick it up. Whereas if you go around in California here, you haven't got a clue whether a rock is a meteorite or just an ordinary rock. But in a place where they've had ice there for millions of years, you can pretty well count on it. And so that's where most of these Martian meteorites have come from, just people wandering around Antarctica and picking up the rocks they find there. Incidentally, you may not be aware that Eskimos were using steel long before anyone else in the world was using steel. Why? Because they just wandered around these places where there's permanent snow, they picked up the rocks, and about 30% of all meteorites are a better grade of stainless steel than you can buy from a metallurgy place. It has a much higher cobalt and nickel content than the stainless steel we can buy. And Eskimos would use these meteorites to make knives and axe blades and so forth because of the quality of what they had. That's been another place where some Martian meteorites have been found. But what these scientists did is they use radio dating methods. That would give them the date as to when the meteorite left Mars. And by the way, they can get three dates: how long it's been in interstellar space, when it left Mars, and when it landed on the Earth. And so they use these radiometric methods to determine that. And then they used thermal chronometers to determine the temperature history of the meteorite over its entire period. Now, the oldest Martian meteorite that's ever been found is about 4.2 billion years old. And most of them are between like 0 and 1.5 billion years old. But it's such that they can actually look at the entire thermal history of Mars in some detail. And that's what this paper is doing. It's the first published report that gives us the thermal history of Mars over the past 4.2 billion years and basically tells the scientific community that Mars has never had a temperature above 0 degrees. Now that's 0 degrees centigrade, so that'd be 32 degrees Fahrenheit. In other words, conditions on Mars have always been freezing water conditions. Mars has never had the temperature conditions over the past 4 billion years that would allow for a stable existence of liquid water. Now we also know that over the past 3.8 billion years, maybe even earlier, that the freezing point for water on Mars has been identical to the boiling point. which means that if you've got water at 0 degrees in a frozen state, it will quickly evaporate and escape to outer space. That's the other thing about Mars, is gravity is not strong enough to retain water vapor in its atmosphere. The only reason why there's any water on Mars at all is that there are places on Mars where the temperature is so low that the ice cannot evaporate. And so that's what you really need is temperatures that are below 80 degrees below zero. If it's colder than 80 degrees below zero, the water will not, the frozen water will not evaporate. If it's warmer than that, the ice will literally evaporate and escape. And so that's why we only find Mars, water on Mars in the frozen state at the poles. It's the only place where it's cold enough that the water, the frozen water, will not immediately evaporate and escape. And by the way, this study also shows them that this temperature applies to the top few kilometers of the surface of Mars. There's been a lot of speculation within NASA, well, the conditions on the surface aren't appropriate for liquid water. Maybe we go down deep enough, we'll find conditions that are appropriate. This tells us you can go down a few kilometers and it's not going to make any difference. It's frozen down through those first few kilometers. But perhaps what was most interesting to me in looking at the paper is that these thermochronometers tell us that the meteorites never got above the boiling point of water from our perspective, which means that it's possible for rocks to hit the Earth, take life with them, and have debris that escapes the Earth's gravity, and then have that stuff orbit the solar system and eventually collide with Mars and land on Mars. Since the temperature never gets above the boiling point of water, that tells us that there's a tiny possibility that life could be transported from planet Earth to Mars. Now, I say a small possibility, because if you let bacteria orbit the solar system for 10 million years, that's enough time to kill the bacteria and to kill their spores. It's not totally a laughing matter. There are actually two species of bacteria that could last 2 or 3 million years orbiting the solar system and land on a body where conditions would be appropriate for germination. They could come to life. That can happen. But if we're talking 10 million years, the probability is zero. And most of the time when a meteorite hits the Earth and sends debris away from Earth's gravity, so it starts to orbit the Sun, you're looking at a few million years orbit time before it lands on the Earth. But occasionally, it can get there in a few thousand years. And for example, one of these 20 Martian meteorites, the travel time in interstellar space from Mars to Earth was 13,000 years. Now, if it's only 13,000 years, you've got quite a few different bacterial species that could survive in a spore state in interstellar space, even with the radiation there, land on Mars, and even germinate. So, in that sense, we can be fairly confident that planet Earth has infected Mars. So Mars is infected with Earth life. Now, does that mean we're going to easily find Earth life on Mars? Well, although conditions do occur on Mars where you can get germination of those spores, where the bacteria would come to life, those conditions only last for a few seconds on the surface. In the interior, they might last for a few years. And so the bottom line is, yes, Earth life, we now know, based on this meteorite study, it does get transported from our planet to Mars, but it's going to be very difficult to find that Earth life on Mars, in the sense that you know, the possibility of it surviving and us being able to find it this time is going to be quite remote. And there's another paper that I got here that explains why it would be even more remote than we think, yes. They've done that, and they can reliably conclude that the atmosphere of Mars has been about the same as what we see today for the past 3.8 billion years. Well, you know that Martian meteorite that President Clinton did a dance around in front of the TV cameras? That one has traces the history of Mars for 4.2 billion years. And it was that particular Martian meteorite that tells us that conditions on Mars, atmospheric conditions, have been stable for the past 3.8 billion years. And that stimulated a theoretical study. Because then a bunch of JPL scientists asked the question, well, has it been stable for 3.8 billion years? What happened to do that? And what they discovered is that unlike planet Earth, you get this, if you have any significant quantity of liquid water anywhere in the Martian environment, that liquid water will quickly react with the carbon dioxide and form carbonates, and the carbonates are not going to ever be returned to the atmosphere. So what that tells us, if Mars ever had a liquid water condition at any time in its history, it would quickly transform the planet into the atmosphere it has right now, which would keep it permanently arid. Because if you pull lots of carbon dioxide out of the Martian atmosphere, there goes your number one greenhouse gas. And with that greenhouse gas gone, that's going to plummet the temperature on Mars down to a condition which will guarantee that the atmosphere will never support a warm, wet condition. So if it's ever warm and wet, it's only going to last literally a few years, because you're going to get a chemical reaction which will quickly pull the water and the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And unlike planet Earth, there's no mechanism to return that stuff to the atmosphere. I'm saying if it ever was thick, it's not going to stay thick for very long. Now, that is speculation. It's quite possible that Mars never had adequate carbon dioxide to set up a greenhouse effect that would allow liquid water to exist on the surface. That's definitely quite possible. On the other hand, there are scientists that point out during the late heavy bombardment, you're going to get a lot of water coming to Mars. The late heavy bombardment peaked at 3.85 billion years ago. It delivered a lot of water to all of the inner solar system bodies. And so in that sense, there would have been a time in Martian history when there would have been significant quantity of water. The problem is that water, and by the way, you'd also get carbon dioxide. You know, if you look at a typical comet, it's water, carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide make up 99% of what a comet is. With water making up about 75 to 80%. So you're going to get a big delivery of carbon dioxide and water, but with that delivery, you get a rapid chemical reaction so that at 3.80 billion years ago, we have Mars permanently dry and cold. That would explain the old channels we see on Mars. The late heavy bombardment, you could explain those old channels. What's been an interesting source of speculation at JPL is that there are some channels on Mars that look to be much younger than 3.8 or 3.9 billion years ago. And this is where all the speculation has been coming. But over the past year, that's now been settled to recognize, yes, there could be water channel cutting in recent times that you could attribute to water at the polar caps being suddenly exposed to a warm condition when the polar axis tilts. Unlike planet Earth, Earth has a gigantic moon that stabilizes the tilt of our rotation axis. Mars does not. And so about every million years on the average, its polar axis will tilt over by as much as 60 or 70 degrees. And when it tilts over like that, all that frozen water up there in the polar area now gets exposed to conditions that are warmer than 80 degrees below zero. And when that happens, you've got the possibility that some of that water could go into a liquid state. And when it goes into liquid state, it can cut a channel. But only it can only cut a channel if it's got a steep slope. Why? Because that water is going to evaporate in a few seconds. So any channel that gets cut has got to get cut fast. And in order to leave a channel, it has to have a steep slope that can run down so the water can quickly run down before it evaporates. Well, as we look at the surface of Mars, all the young channels are in steep slopes. So in that sense, it could be explained, although there are other JPL scientists are saying, we don't think it was cut by liquid water. There's two other scenarios. One was that it was cut by frozen water running down when that water reached a point where it got a little bit warmer, its flow characteristics, so it'd be like an avalanche of frozen water. And then there's another group that are saying it's not water at all, those are dust channels. In the sense that if you get a lot of dust accumulating on Mars on a steep slope, you'll get a dust avalanche. And that's now viewed to be the most likely explanation of the channels. If they're not water at all, they're dust channels. Why? Because there's lots of dust on Mars, and that dust, I mean, you get a really violent dust storm about every 12 to 18 months. And by violent, I mean 300 miles an hour. In fact, the dust storms on Mars are so violent, they pick up boulders and throw them around at several hundred miles an hour. So with that quantity of dust on Mars, it's inevitable you're going to get dust accumulation on steep slopes that will become unstable and cut a channel. Just like, you know, I was raised in Canada, and there's places all over Canada where you look up at a mountain and there's these huge scars. Well, those are snow avalanches, but you can get dust avalanches of doing the same thing. Okay, but as I said, the most interesting thing about this paper is making the point that it really does look like planet Earth has infected the surface of Mars several times because of the fact that we see that the temperature doesn't get high enough to sterilize that life. So in that sense, if NASA looks hard enough, they should find the remains of life on Mars. I'm saying the possibility for viable life is quite remote. Not impossible, but quite remote. You have to dig underground and just make a lucky find of a bacterium that's in a viable condition. But in terms of the remains of Earth life, you should find quite a bit. Matter of fact, it should add up to about a pound of Earth life remains for every square kilometer. Now, that sounds like a lot, but just think of how big a square kilometer is, and you spread out 1 pound over that whole square kilometer. It's not going to be an easy task for NASA to find that signature. On the other hand, with the kind of technology they plan to put on the surface of the Mars in the next 10 years, I would predict they should find it within a decade. It shouldn't be that difficult. I'd also say, if you want to find the remains of Earth life, the best place to look is the Moon. The Moon gets a lot more Earth meteorites than Mars does. In fact, we would estimate, well, they estimate that 20,000 tons of Earth material is distributed on every 100 square kilometers of the Moon's surface. So figure that about 5% of that is the remains of Earth life. That still adds up to a lot of life per square kilometer. So my suggestion is you want to find the remains of Earth life beyond Earth. The surface of the Moon is the best place to look. And incidentally, I'm excited about that because in our book, The Origins of Life, we make the point that geology on planet Earth destroys any Earth fossil older than 3.5 billion years. There is no hope of finding fossils of life on the surface of the Earth older than 3.5 billion years, but we have chemical evidence that tells us that life was abundant on planet Earth back to 3.8 billion years. Well, where are you going to find the fossils of Earth life that are between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years? You're going to find them on the Moon. The Moon's going to have the fossils of the Earth's first life. And that, in my opinion, is reason enough to go back to the Moon. Find those fossils. It'd be really quite exciting to see what the fossils of Earth's first life really looked like. And we're predicting in our Origins of Life book that if you can find the fossils of Earth's first life, you'll find that there are dozens of different species of bacteria. Not just one. You can see dozens of different species. The proof of that is on the surface of the Moon, not on the Earth. Question from here? Yes. Well, it's not that there's no atmosphere on Mars. It's that the atmosphere of Mars is only about 6% of what you have here on the Earth. So take our atmosphere and reduce it down to 1/16. That's what you have. And because it is so rare, only 1/16 of what the planet Earth has, that means that wind velocities are much higher than they are. I mean, both planets have a 24-hour rotation rate, but the wind velocities do depend on the air pressure. If you got very low air pressure, you can get much higher wind velocities. And so that's why they get 300-mile-per-hour storms that are planet-wide that can last for months. So, you know, we worry about a hurricane that lasts for a couple of days. On Mars, they have storms as devastating as any tornado that is planet-wide, not just a tiny region, and it literally lasts for several months. There is a little bit of air on Mars. Not enough to breathe, but there is a little bit. Yes, in the back. Oh, the moon is affected by the late heavy bombardment. So yeah, if you go earlier than 3.8 billion years on the moon, you can expect that stuff to be severely chemically and physically reorganized. Well, actually, there's a fair amount of bombardment between 3.5 and 3.8. So in that sense, you might reduce your 5% figure down a little bit, because there will be places on the moon that will be too damaged by those impacts. But it's not going to be a global impact event like with the late heavy bombardment. The late heavy bombardment refigured the entire surface of the moon. The bombardments after that would be local, they wouldn't be global. So in that sense, if you look on the surface of the moon, you should find these very early fossils of life. And you know, that'd be a great way to put to the test these different creation evolution models. So in that sense, I'm excited. I'd like to see my tax dollars go in that direction. And I got a suggestion for the government: scale down the Mars program, and you'll have plenty of money for the lunar program. Yes. Okay, that took place when the Earth was, that was 4.50 billion years ago. So it's long before there was any life on the planet, long before there were oceans, long before you even had an atmosphere that wasn't opaque to light. So, but that did form the moon, and by the way, it's a good thing it happened right at that time. You know, one article I'm writing makes the point that if you move the collision slightly earlier than 4.5 billion years ago, or slightly later than 4.5 billion years ago, you wind up with a planet that's permanently sterile. So the timing of that Mars-sized planet that collided with the Earth is critical for whether or not you get life existing on Earth thereafter. Okay, let me get you to the other discovery. The other discovery is chemistry. And it was done by a group of scientists who noticed that even with the Voyager missions to Mars, which goes back to 1971 and 76, I believe, is when those two landers came on Mars, that they found that the Martian soil had an excess of sulfur and chlorine. Now, the speculation was that that was a local event, that that wasn't the condition of the entire Martian environment. And the reason the concern about sulfur and chlorine, the quantity of sulfur and chlorine they found in those soils at the Voyager sites is so high that it would be toxic to any kind of prebiotic chemistry, and therefore prove that life could not possibly originate on the surface of Mars. Okay, what has happened now that we've got these new landers on Mars that are wandering around to a considerable distance, and they're finding is that this was not exceptional, that this high sulfur and chlorine abundance in the Martian soil is ubiquitous to Mars. It's everywhere. And also the spectrometer of the orbiter going around Mars. The Europeans have the satellite that's orbiting Mars now, and that spectrometer is also telling us that this high sulfur and chlorine abundance is ubiquitous all over Mars. The other thing that this paper points out is that the soil is much more strongly oxidizing than Earth soils. And as I've told you before in the class, and as you can also see in the Origins of Life book we have here, oxygen is toxic to prebiotic chemistry. Even a very tiny amount of oxygen in the environment shuts down any possibility that simple molecules can assemble into things like amino acids and nucleic bases and sugars that could lead to the proteins and the DNA and the RNA that would make life possible. And they also have been able to demonstrate that this has been a permanent condition of Mars, and so you can literally write Mars off as a candidate for any possible origin of life chemistry. Its soil is simply too oxidizing, too much sulfur, and too much chlorine to make it happen. Now, they've done some comparisons with planet Earth. And so what they've done is they've gone around to planet Earth and saying, okay, let's look for the most inhospitable locations on the planet for life. And basically that would be the high Andean desert in the north part of Chile. It's the only place on planet Earth other than Antarctica. That's not actually true. Antarctica does have plant life on it, even in a place where there's a lot of ice. But this is the one place on planet Earth where you can wander around and see no green plants. Why? It never gets any rain. The other thing we notice is the soil is filled with heavy metals, and heavy metals are toxic to life in quantity. But what they notice is even in this most inhospitable place on planet Earth, they find that the amount of carbonaceous compounds is at least 10,000 times higher than anywhere on Mars. And carbonaceous compounds are not prebiotic molecules, but they're the precursors to these simple prebiotics that could lead to things as simple as amino acids and these nitrogenous bases. And so by those marks, we would realize Mars is no longer a candidate. Now, I'm predicting that these two papers combined will dampen the enthusiasm that life could have possibly arisen on Mars. As I say in our book, The Origins of Life, I wrote the chapter in that book, there's already enough evidence even a year ago to rule out Mars as a candidate. That's just icing on the cake. This should convince all the remaining skeptics that Mars is not a possible candidate for the origin of life. That being the case, there's no possibility for indigenous life to exist on Mars. And in that sense, NASA can save their time and money looking for indigenous life on Mars. These papers, combined with the other papers I mentioned in the Origins of Life book, by themselves are adequate to prove that that's simply not possible. On the other hand, it does demonstrate that Earth life's remains, should be there. And that's one of the reasons why I'm bringing it up here in the class. It's not that easy to distinguish between indigenous life and transported life. But these papers will tell us any remains we find on Mars cannot possibly be indigenous. They must be transported from Earth to Mars. I also find it amusing that we have all these space agencies around the world carefully sterilizing their spacecraft before they send them to Mars so we don't infect Mars. Well, in one sense, that's already happened, thanks to these meteorites. The other thing NASA's finally begin to recognize, it's not possible to sterilize a spacecraft so that we can guarantee that there's nothing living on it when it reaches Mars. You can do a job of minimizing it, but you cannot guarantee that there won't be any contamination. A rocket going through the atmosphere is enough to lead to the possibility of some contamination. So we can simply minimize it. We can't eliminate that possibility. Okay, no more questions. Let's jump into Job 40 and see if we can finish up what we started last week. I had no idea what I said last week was going to be so controversial, but that's what makes this class fun. The Lord said to Job, beginning in Job 40, and Job 40, God is speaking, and God is interrupting this big debate between five philosophers and scientists of that time. We're talking about 3,500 years ago. And the Lord said to Job, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him." Then Job answered the Lord, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I'll say no more." Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice?" And by the way, I believe he's saying this to all five men, not just to Job. "Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself?" And if you go back over the previous, the first 34 chapters, what you notice are these five men, brilliant men of their day. What they're talking about is, well, the reason, Job, you're going through this is because God is doing things to try to correct you. And then this leads into a big debate about what God would do and wouldn't do in terms of the way he has structured life on planet Earth. And the Lord, naturally, here is getting a little bit upset about these guys speculating about what he would do and what he would not do, why he would do it. And he basically makes the point, you're all unworthy to even ask those kinds of questions. You really don't know as much about this record of nature as you think you know. And as I mentioned last week, this has relevance today, because what we see today are leading biologists making accusations about this Christian creator in an attempt to prove that the Christian God cannot possibly be responsible for life here on planet Earth. And their proof that God cannot possibly be responsible, by the way, the nicer ones among them are not saying we're trying to prove that God does not exist. We're just simply demonstrating that if he does exist, he plays no role in the history of life here on planet Earth, which I would argue is just as offensive for a Christian. I mean, what you're saying is, okay, you can believe in God and pretend that God exists, but just realize God plays no role in your existence or the existence of any other life on planet Earth. And as I mentioned last week, they have a list of about nine at my count. I went through the internet just to try to pick up all these arguments. And the main argument is that we see all these bad designs in nature, and if we're talking the God of the Bible, God does not do bad designs. Therefore, since we see bad designs, that prove that God is not responsible for life here on planet Earth. That was an argument that Stephen Gould made in one of his best-selling books, published in 1981, and it was titled Panda's Thumb. And the Panda's Thumb was kind of a centerpiece of proof that they're bad designs of nature, and therefore the Christian explanation can't possibly be correct. But in that book, there are other examples, and I mentioned last week there's the appendix. The human appendix for decades was considered to be a useless artifact that was a hangover from our evolutionary past. Likewise, our tailbone. It was presumed that we evolved from the monkeys. Monkeys have long tails. And as we evolved from the monkeys, our tails got shorter and shorter and shorter. But we're still left with this residual tailbone that we inherited from the monkeys. By the way, I was taught that in my public school up in Canada. I was in grade 2. They gave me that story, but I also heard it in my biology class when I was in grade 10, that we have this this tailbone. And then there's a complaint about the shape of the human backbone, the fact that it's got this strange S shape in it, and how that shape they would attribute to being a bad design. And I mentioned last week, and this I think where I got myself into trouble, male nipples. I think I gave you an adequate answer to that last week. So you can get the tape from last week if you want that. Then I got a few more here. One that was on the Jon Stewart show. And keep in mind, if you haven't heard of Jon Stewart, he's on Comedy Central. I see this happening quite frequently. It's happened to me in the past, where in trying to ridicule the Christian faith, they'll bring on this, quote, Christian expert, and then they'll try to embarrass the expert. Well, what happened with Jon Stewart's show is they brought in Bill Dembski, and he's one of the top leaders in the intelligent design movement. He's published a number of books on how to infer design by looking at the mathematical patterns, and Jon Stewart immediately hit him with, well, I mean, it can't possibly be an intelligent designer because we human beings have this paper-thin scrotal sac. And I've seen this tactic used frequently. Bring up something sexual that will embarrass the Christian leader, or at least catch him off guard, and then you can make a joke and kind of ridicule and marginalize a Christian. And so I just let you know this is going to happen. I put male nipples in that same category, okay? They know that Christians don't like to talk about sex or anything sexual, and so they'll purposely bring up something that is sexual in order to embarrass you, get you to blush, get everybody laughing, and ridicule and marginalize and get on to something else. That's exactly what happened to poor Bill Dembski. And so I'm simply mentioning this that it's a good idea to realize this tactic will be used and to prepare yourself in advance. And you can really disarm them if you don't get embarrassed. You can also disarm them if you can throw a little bit of humor back their way. And you can also disarm them if you've got a ready answer for what they think is a bad design. So I'll talk to you about that in a minute. But some others on the list are, you know, if there's an intelligent designer out there, if you're talking to God that inspired the words of the Bible, surely he could have designed the carnivores to be better carnivores. Or he could have designed the herbivores to be better herbivores. Or he could have designed the herbivores to have better defenses against the carnivores. Then you can bring up the parasites and all these other issues. And again, we need to have a ready answer for that. And incidentally, we've already been studying that answer in the book of Job, particularly Job 34 through to 37, got us into that question of how God designs the carnivores, the herbivores, and the plants in an ideal fashion. But that's often brought up. God could have done it better. Okay, how do we answer that? Well, what I really want to do is kind of take you through a few of these, but then give you some general questions you can ask when you get caught with something where you say, I have no idea why that bad design really is a good design. That will happen to you a few times. It's happened to me. Then you've got to go back and study. But it's always good to have some questions that you can ask that will work if you know nothing at all about the subject matter. Okay, so I want to give you those. But in terms of, by the way, are we all okay on Panda's thumb, the appendix? The tailbone and the nipples we covered last week. Any questions for those of you who were here last week? Okay, well, what the medical people claim, this goes back at least 100 years, because they noticed that they could take an appendix out of a human being that had ruptured or was close to rupturing, and you could live a normal life. And so, and it's also quite small. And so the presumption is that this is a useless organ, serves no purpose. And as we mentioned last week, there were several decades, almost 50-year period, when surgeons would routinely remove the appendix, even if there was nothing wrong with it. As long as they had your abdomen open for some other reason, they would always take the appendix out, because that way you wouldn't have to worry about it ever getting into serious inflammation. They've now stopped doing that because they've discovered that the appendix really does serve a good purpose. But the theory was this, is that when we look in other animals, we notice that what appears to be an appendix is much bigger and larger than it is in the human species, and that this helped facilitate the digestion for that particular creature. But as these apes and hominids evolved, they wound up changing their diet, and therefore their intestines and their bowel changed. And when we have this little appendix, which is kind of a hangover from evolution, and we really don't need it because we're eating much more refined foods than what people, what our supposed monkey ancestors ate in the past. Well, what they now realize is that the appendix indeed serves no purpose in digestion, but it serves a rather significant purpose in the human immune response system. And therefore, surgeons have stopped removing the appendix because they know it does serve a good purpose. They only remove it if it's inflamed and is in danger of bursting, because, you know, it does serve this purpose. Now, that was only discovered about 10 years ago. Okay. They used to think a human immune response system was simply in the blood. And so there'd be these white blood cells. And they thought that was the whole story. Scientists now realize that the immune response system, not just for the human species, but for all species, is far more complex than that. And that we find all kinds of different factors within the body that facilitates the immune response. Now, in terms of exactly what role the appendix takes, I can't tell you off the top of my head. It's something we discussed on Creation Update about 6 months ago. So if you want to get the whole scoop on that, you can listen to that on our reasons.org website. Or come back next week, or when I'm back here, 3 weeks from now? and I'll get you an answer to that, but I can't tell you off the top of my head. But it is something that scientists no longer dispute, that the appendix does play an important role in the human immune system, probably because it's in the digestive area, and you know, there's a lot of bacterial and fungi and other stuff that get into our digestive tract. And well, what I don't see, I'm speculating. It's not good for me to speculate. I really don't know. Yes. Right. Well, that's something new that's come out of the medical community, is now that we realize the appendix is not an evolutionary hangover, a useless artifact from our evolutionary past, but rather does serve this purpose. The question then asked is there something about human behavior that causes us to get these inflamed appendices and having it rupture? And that's why they're now encouraging people to make sure that they don't eat as refined a diet as what's typical for modern Americans. And therefore, you want to make sure that you get enough fiber in your diet, that you keep your digestive tract healthy so that you're not going to endanger the appendix. Because bottom line is, you really don't want to lose your appendix. Do what you can to keep it. And if you have one of these soda pop and icing cake diets, it's probably going to more likely cause that to be a problem than if you live a healthy diet. What's healthy for your appendix is also healthy for minimizing the risk of bowel cancer. So there's lots of good reasons why you should have a diet that's relatively high in fiber and a variety of fibers. Okay? Yeah, it's your comment. They used to do that. The biology textbooks have now come up to date on that one. But the old ones would say that the tailbone was a useless artifact. Well, it might have been useless for your biology teacher who never did ballet. But I would argue that it wasn't even useless for him, because we now know that that little short tailbone really does play a role not only in making us bipedal, but in doing everything else we do with our backbone. The reason why they thought it was a useless artifact is they said, well, if you can get rid of that tailbone, you can actually have a greater stability for standing and walking. However, we do more than just standing and walking. You know, part of the human existence is being able to sleep and being able to sit. We do a lot of sitting. And you know, and sitting requires a different kind of posture than standing up. And then we're able to carry loads. You know, carrying, say, an 80-pound backpack puts a different demand on the backbone than simply being able to stop and just run around. I mean, one of the problems is they looked at other life forms and they said, well, you know, they have this backbone structure, but that's because of what they do, but we're very different than the animals. We not only walk and run, we sit. I mean, you really don't see other creatures sitting at a desk with a computer console all day, but we have to do that. And our backbone's got to be able to survive that. And then we carry loads. We stand erect. We're the only species of life, excuse me, that stands erect and carries a load, or is able to walk or run with a load on her back. And that requires a different demand. And then keep in mind, somebody afterwards asked a question about the vertebrates. you know, we have all these vertebrates, and there have been those people have criticized that, saying the backbone would be more stable for an erect posture if we had fewer vertebrates. And so, say if we had big vertebrates like that instead of small vertebrates, and you know, some of you have probably gone through back operations where they fuse the vertebrae, and so they put several vertebrae together to try to stabilize your back so that you'll be able to walk without pain. Well, that does work, but it comes at a price. And then the other thing we need to realize about our backbone, it not only helps us in our posture and supporting the skeleton, allowing the skeleton to do all of the way the backbone is structured, it has all these nerves that run out at the different vertebrate gaps. So you've got these little bones here, a set of nerves that runs out here, a set of nerves that runs out at the top. And if you get a back injury, that might wipe out or damage some of those nerves, but the other nerves are okay. Now, if you only have, say, 5 or 6 vertebrae, I don't know, how many vertebrae do we have in our back? 20-some-odd? Okay. If you only had, say, 4 or 5, then that means if you had a damage taking place in one vertebrae joint, that would affect many more nerves than what if you had, say, 23 or whatever the number of vertebrae we have. So in other words, the human backbone is designed in such a way that it can tolerate a certain amount of injury. Fewer bones, and it's less injury tolerant than our backbone would be. Yes. That's exactly what I'm referring. Yes. That God knew in advance there would come a day in the life of the human species when we'd be sitting at desks for 8 or 9 hours a day. I mean, we didn't do that in the beginning. Right. But I mean, even the context of the book of Job, my guess is these 5 guys were sitting down when they were having their debate. So, yeah, I mean, sitting on rocks or whatever. So even early on, we were doing a fair amount of sitting, but there's no question we do more sitting today than our ancestors did 500 years ago. Yes. Right. 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 Right, right. Yeah, squatting puts a whole new set of demands. I mean, the backbone is now recognized by medical researchers as an amazing design. It is an amazing design, and it's able to accommodate so many different functions. The problem with the people who said that the S shape in the backbone is a bad design, they're only looking at one function of the backbone, which is basically to be able to walk erect. But our backbone is able to accommodate more than just erectile walking. In the back. Right. Well, we go back to the chair idea, and those of you who have to sit a lot, I have to sit a lot in my job, okay? But if you're sitting at a computer console for, you know, 10 or whatever hours a day, what you notice is that sometimes you sit like this, and sometimes you sit like this, sometimes you sit like this, sometimes, I mean, what you do is you vary it, put your elbows up and so forth. Your backbone is designed to be able to handle that. And because your backbone is able to handle that, you can shift the stress on a whole lot of different muscles in your body, which makes it possible for you to sit at a desk that many hours. If you just sat in one position and held that, in fact, you can try that next time you go to the office. Just sit at your desk and hold that position and see how long you can hold it. You won't be able to hold it for very long, but thank God that we have a backbone designed by our Creator that enables it not only to be able to move back and forth like this and swivel, as you see in other animals, it's able to do stuff like this. So, and incidentally, that's helpful for certain swimming maneuvers. I imagine it's helpful for ballet too, that you can make these sideway motions as well as back and forward. Okay, any more? Yes. Right. Right, right. Well, one of the things that was interesting about this panda's thumb, you know, we have Gould publishing this in 1981 saying this is a very clumsy design, and he basically says, I could have designed a much better thumb for the panda than what this so-called Christian God designed. Yeah, I mean, you got to watch some of the blasphemy that's in these books. As it tells us in the Bible, there are people who blaspheme and do not realize it. So, but a group of Japanese researchers, by the way, it was a Canadian biologist that just 2 years after Gould published Panda's Thumb, came up with his own book on Panda's Thumb and made the point that it was a very elegant design for stripping bamboo off the tree. But what happened about a year and a half ago is six Japanese researchers decided to look at the panda's thumb, the whole hand actually, and they did a computer modeling of the whole hand. And it was all based on the idea, you know, if there is a bad design here, maybe we've overlooked something, and this is an elegant design and not a bad design. And so they designed this computer program to look for elegant designs in the panda's thumb, and they found a whole bunch. And what they discovered is what this biologist published in 1983 is just the tip of the iceberg. And that this is a creature who has this uniquely designed a hand that enables it to very efficiently strip leaves off of a bamboo tree. And, you know, their point was the six Japanese physicists who did it. By the way, they weren't biologists, they were physicists who looked at this hand and designed this computer program to look for optimal designs. Their comment was, well, why don't you just go out in a bamboo forest and see how well you can do stripping leaves off the bamboo tree with this, quote, great hand design that we have. And what you discover is, our hand is not that well designed as the panda's is for dealing with that. But you're right, the panda did not always eat an exclusively bamboo diet. And in terms of being able to catch small animals, you know, the way your hand is structured isn't a big issue, but it is if you're going to be going after those bamboo leaves. And the thing about a bamboo forest, it's extremely thick. I don't know if you've ever been in a bamboo forest. You really can't walk in a bamboo forest. You got to cut your way through it because it's so thick. And again, the panda's body and hand is designed in such a way that it can climb up these things, get into an area where it's got room and can strip the leaves. Yes. Twist. Dance. I mean, look at all the crazy dances our teenagers do. I mean, you do all that too. Ski, skate. So. Mm-hmm. Right. And do it better, and protect the spinal column, the spinal cord as well. I mean, the way the bones are structured is an incredibly elegant design in terms of just protecting that column of nerves. You're very dependent on that nerve column. Yeah. Thank you. that's very apropos, this whole point that the cat does have extra vertebrae, which allows the backbone to act as a spring. And because it can act as a spring, a cat can drop from a much greater height and not experience injury, whereas we would definitely be injured. It also enables a cat to jump. Have you ever looked at a common house cat and just how high they can jump? They wouldn't be able to jump that high if it wasn't for their backbone. On the other hand, cats are much more subject to spinal injury than other animals are because they do have so many vertebrae there. It is so flexible and spring-like. It's much easier for them to suffer an injury. And in the wild, that happens, where cats get injured and that's really the end of their existence because they can no longer feed themselves. The giraffe, his neck is not very flexible. If you ever watched a giraffe in the wild or even in a zoo, there's not much flexibility there. And that's because of the fact that the bones have been elongated. And so, but you can also point out the giraffe doesn't need as much flexibility. It specializes in feeding on things that are very high and doesn't have a lot of competition. And it's big enough that a lion comes around, he can just give him a swift kick. That's how a giraffe, that's literally how they defend themselves against the predators, which is why the predators recognize that the only way they're ever going to get a giraffe is they have to get it while it's drinking. Because, the giraffe has to spread its legs out, has to drop down this very inflexible neck in order to drink, and if they can sneak up on the giraffe, they might have a chance for a kill. Of course, the giraffe are wary looking around like that, but again, their neck can't turn that much because of the way their vertebrae is designed. But it's really the only way you're going to get a neck that long so you can reach up and get that stuff. So, and by the way, there's been a lot of studies on dinosaurs with long necks and how, the blood flow problem to the brain and all that. And what they're now recognizing is that these dinosaurs that had very long necks were probably aquatic. And so you would get some additional support from that long neck just from the fact that a lot of that neck would have been in water. And in fact, the ones with the longest necks never got out of the water. They were just swimmers. And that would give some support to the neck. You can also look at snakes in the same way. The biggest snake in the world is an anaconda, but the anaconda can only live in the water. You take that anaconda out of water and its backbone simply can't support the weight of the snake anymore. And so it's got this one reason why you see it running around in the Amazon. So that's why the python isn't quite as big. The python's about as big as you can go with a snake before the backbone becomes a problem. So, quick lesson in backbone engineering dynamics. Let me spend a little bit of time on this. Well, not much time here, but the scrotal sac. And, John Stewart's derision here was, this can't be the God of the Bible because the scrotal sac is paper thin. It's kind of like your point here. God knew ahead of time that we would be doing a lot of sitting. And, sitting in a desk in a little cubicle where you can't move around much. So he designed our backbone ahead of time to be able to handle that. Well, the problem with human beings in terms of their scrotal sac, John Stewart is right. If you look at other animals, they have a much more heavily armored, if you like, a scrotal sac. Why? Because the scrotal sac is more subject to injury, and also with other animals, the problem is to keep the testicles from freezing, from getting too cold. With a human species, we got the opposite problem, and that's trying to keep them cool enough. And see, unlike other animals, we wear clothes, okay? And we're also bipedal. The fact that we're bipedal, and if you look at the big muscles on a human being, they're basically in the upper leg, which means you've got a lot of blood flow going right by that scrotal sac. And that blood flow heats the scrotal sac. And then you're wearing clothes. So there's a need to keep that scrotal sac cool enough that the human species can reproduce. In fact, that's been a problem in Japan. They actually determined that their birth rate was dropping. Why? Because the Japanese spend so much time in hot water. I mean, literal hot water, not just... you've been to Japan, you know what it's like. They have these huge tubs that they get in, these furrows, I think is what they call them. Yeah, and but if you sit in there for several hours, that heats up the scrotal sac. and they actually determined that that was partly responsible for the fact that the Japanese had a lower birth rate than people in other parts of the world. So the big problem here is to keep the scrotal sac cool enough, and having it paper thin really does help keep it cool enough. Now, I would wish Bill Dembski had said all that on the Jon Stewart show, and if he could set it with a few jokes, I think he would have really got somewhere. Yes. Right. So, well, actually, I think God would have, whether we had sinned or not, we would wind up wearing clothes, because clothes would enable us to go into the northern latitudes, whereas you wouldn't be able to do that without clothes. But isn't it interesting how he pre-designed the scrotal sac ahead of time to enable us to go into a cold climate where we would wear clothes, where we could actually run fast on two legs? It's one thing to walk, but if you do a marathon, for example, you will notice that there's a lot of heat gathering in your scrotal sac. I mean, you're going to notice that. You'll notice that after a few miles. And it's really a good thing that it is paper thin, otherwise we'd be in big trouble as human beings. So, this is a beautiful design. But Jon Stewart picked up on something. We're the only species that has that kind of a scrotal sac. Now, if we're taking the attitude of Job here, you would say, look, we're the only species that has this. We're more advanced in many ways than other species. Could it be that there's some hidden purpose here that I haven't found? And that's really what God is saying here to these five men. He's saying, would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? And what we're really doing is saying here, I think I'm smart enough to figure this out. This looks like a terrible design. And then what you really need to do is say, no, wait a minute. We seem to be exceptional. Maybe there's something about our scrotal sac that really fits into why we're so exceptional. Or I think it was really great to say, this has got to be the God of the Bible, because only the God of the Bible would make a species that's pre-designed for a future condition. There's nothing in the evolutionary model that would anticipate that. To me, this is one of the strongest arguments of all against evolution. Evolution simply would not be able to put design features into a species that had no purpose until thousands of years had gone by. In fact, what evolutionary theories tell us, if it has no purpose and it carries a cost, evolution will get rid of it. And the fact is, we retained our capacity to sit in front of a computer desk for thousands of years when it had no practical utility. And incidentally, that goes for a lot of our other capabilities that we have. The human species carried, at great cost, a load that evolution would have weeded out. And it didn't happen in the human species. In my opinion, one of the best examples of that is our capacity for higher mathematics and our capacity for prayer. Our capacity for prayer and higher mathematics has no utility in terms of trying to survive in a Stone Age culture. And we were there for 40,000 years. For 40,000 years, that's where the human species was. And yet we carried this load. Now you say, what load? Your capacity to do mathematics, your capacity to pray and to communicate with your Creator requires a considerable segment of your brain structure to support that ability. And only we human beings have that brain structure. And that brain structure demands a lot of blood flow. In fact, 35% of your blood flow supports your brain. Now, in order to make room for those brain structures that support higher mathematics and prayer, and a lot of artistic expression, it was necessary to get rid of a lot of stuff that's vital for our survival. That's why we human beings have a terrible sense of smell. A good sense of smell takes considerable brain tissue to support. That was sacrificed to make room for brain tissue that would support nonlinear tensor calculus. Okay? Yes. Yes. No doubt. Okay, and we actually see that in some of the species that share the planet with us. And but we have a right. But you're right, we have a capacity to design tools to a much higher degree. But what scientists have done is to look at the brain and say, how much brain tissue do you need for these different functions? And one of the things they discovered is you need a lot of brain tissue to support spiritual activity. A good percentage of our brain, and we're the only species that has that brain structure. I forget the percentage, but it's really quite large, something like 9 or 10%, which enables us to do that. And that carries a cost. A lot of blood flow goes to support that. And because the human brain is already at maximum size, you literally could not make a species with a bigger brain than us human beings. You know, this idea, we see these science fiction shows where they show this guy with an enormous brain. It's ludicrous. Because if the brain was that big, it would cook itself to death. Our brain is at the maximum heat level. Make the human brain any bigger than what it is, and the human brain would cook itself to death. So you can't make the human brain any bigger. So in order to make room for prayer, to make room for mathematics, you've got to get rid of other things. Yes. That's correct. It's very important that you don't use the whole of your brain, because otherwise it would remain full, and you wouldn't be able to put anything else in it. Okay? I mean, think of a computer analogy. You know, a computer is not a complete analogy for the brain, but it is analogous for certain functions of the brain. And one of the things you learn when you're working on computers is you don't want to work with a hard disk that's 98% full. If it's 98% full, then there's a whole lot of things you can't do with a computer because it needs memory space. And so in terms of what is the most efficient use of the brain, it's when you're using about 15% of its memory. So you want 85% to be empty. So that's why it's got to be that way. If you go beyond that 15% level, you can't think as well as you do. Which is why I'm telling people, by the way, I'm out of time, but what I'm telling you is that one more question, I'll take one, but make a comment too. And that is, if you want your brain to function at maximum capacity and efficiency, you must train yourself to forget stuff you don't need to know. Okay? It's just like with a computer. You got to erase those files that you don't need to make room for the stuff you do need to know. Yes? Yeah. Right. Well, one of the beautiful things about not only the human body, but the bodies of other species, is how they're able to tolerate injury to different components. So, for example, the brain is not only designed for maximum capacity, efficiency, and throughput, it's also designed to be able to recover when parts of the brain have been injured. So, for example, I got a relative who suffered serious brain damage about 15 years ago. Completely wiped out his speech center, and it was 2 years before he could talk at all. Well, now he's talking virtually. He's got a full vocabulary now. The only thing I noticed with him is that he has to speak more slowly than he did before he had the injury. But that's simply an example where other parts of the brain can take over as certain parts get injured. And what you're talking about fits into that category is that, you know, you can be born with these congenital problems and the brain can still function. All of this, of course, is within limits. If you damage the brain too much, then you've got a problem. But it's amazing how the brain can survive in the face of injury. And there again, having some stuff that you don't totally need is a factor here, like it is with a backbone. If you knock out a vertebrae, you can probably still walk. If you knock out 6 vertebrae, probably you're not going to make it. But suppose you only had 6 vertebrae to start with and you knock out one of them, chances are you won't be able to walk. So we're out of time. We'll pick this up next week. What I really want to do is equip you with some questions to ask where you don't know a thing about what the person's talking about, okay? There's some good questions we can ask. And one little tip I'll give you is this. Isn't it interesting that all the examples of bad design you see from the evolutionists are where things are the most complex from a biological perspective? Why is it that all the bad design examples are where things are most complicated? If you think about that, then you've got some good questions you can pose back to the evolutionist that says, this can't be God. Father in heaven, we thank you that we are living in a day and an age when we face challenges we haven't faced in the past, Lord, and it gives us new opportunities to share the good news of what Jesus Christ has done for us in creating this universe and dying on the cross and giving us the evidence that, number one, we need you, and number two, we can't help ourselves, and number three, you're there prepared to help address our problems. Thank you, Lord, that your characteristics, your attributes, your love, your power, your wisdom, your justice is so evident in the created realm, so much more evident today than it was in the past. Lord, as we look at this evidence, help us to graciously and wisely and lovingly communicate that to people who do not yet know you as Lord and Savior. And by that means, may they come into a relationship with you that's greater than any relationship they've ever experienced. In Jesus' name, amen.